recognize that discomfort. But the moment he did, he would be subject to the tribe's damage, embroiled in their every blood feud, and never allowed to leave the city again. "I don't think I'm ready for a wife just yet," he said.
"Well, don't wait too long, or men will think you pushting," Jadir said, laughing and punching Arlen's shoulder.
Arlen wasn't sure what the word meant, but he nodded anyway.
"How long have you been in the city, my friend?" Jadir asked.
"Only a few hours," Arlen said. "I just delivered my messages to the palace."
"And already you've come to offer your spear." "I ever am,"
Jadir cried to his fellows.
"The Parchin must have Krasian blood in him."
His men joined in his laughter.
"Walk with me,"
Jadir said, putting his arm on Arlen's shoulder and moving away from the others.
Arlen knew Jadir was already trying to decide where he would best fit in the night's battle.
"The Bajin lost a pit warder last night," he said. "You could fill in there."
Pit warders were among the most important of the Krasian soldiers, warding the demon pits used to trap Korlings, and assuring that the wards activated after the demons fell in. It was risky work, for if the tarps used to disguise the pits didn't fall in and reveal the wards fully, there was little to prevent a sand demon from climbing out and killing the warder as he tried to uncover them. There was only one position with a higher mortality rate.
"Pushguard, I would prefer," Arlen replied.
Jadir shook his head, but he was smiling.
"Always the most dangerous duty for you," he chided. "If you are killed, who will carry our letters?"
Arlen understood the sarcasm, even through Jardir's thick accent. Letters meant little to him. Few Dal Shaaram could even read.
"Not so dangerous this night," Arlen said.
Unable to contain his excitement, he unrolled his new spear, holding it up to the first warrior proudly.
"A kingly weapon," Jadir agreed. "But it's the warrior that wins through in the night, Parchin, not the spear."
He put his hand on Arlen's shoulder and looked him in the eyes.
"Don't put too much faith in your weapon. I've seen warriors more seasoned than you paint their spears and come to a bitter end."
"I didn't make it," Arlen said. "I found it in the ruins of Anaxun."
"The birthplace of the Deliverer?"
Jardir laughed.
"The spear of Khaji is a myth, Parchin, and the lost city has been reclaimed by the sands."
Arlen shook his head.
"I've been there," he said. "I can take you there."
"I am Sharam Ka of the Desert Spear, Parchin," Jardir replied. "I cannot just pack a camel and ride off into the sand looking for a city that exists only in ancient texts."
"I think I'll convince you when night falls," Arlen said.
Jardir smiled patiently.
"Promise me that you will not try anything foolish," he said. "Warded spear or no, you are not the Deliverer. It would be sad to bury you."
"I promise," Arlen said.
"Good then."
Jardir clapped him on the shoulder.
"Come, my friend, the hour grows late. You shall sup in my palace tonight. Before we muster outside, Sharikora."
They supped on spiced meats, ground peas, and paper-thin layers of bread the Krasian women made by spreading wet meal on hot, polished rocks. Arlen had a place of honor next to Jardir, surrounded by Kai Shaaram and served by Jardir's own wives. Arlen never understood why Jardir paid him so much respect, but after his treatment at the Andras Palace, it was most welcome. The men begged stories of him, calling for the tale of One Arm's crippling, though they had heard it many times. Always it was tales of One Arm, or Alagai Ka, as they called him. Rock demons were rare in Krasia, and as Arlen complied, his audience sat entranced by the tale.
"We built a new scorpion after your last visit, Parchin," one of the Kai Shaaram told him as they sipped their nectar after the meal. "It can punch a spear through a sandstone wall. We'll find a way to pierce Alagai Ka's hide yet."
Arlen chuckled and shook his head. "I'm afraid you will not see One Arm tonight," he said, "or ever again. He has seen the sun." The eyes of the Kai Sharam bulged.
Alagai Ka is dead? One asked. How did you manage this?
Arlan smiled. I will tell you the tale after tonight's victory, he said. He stroked the spear next to him gently as he did. A gesture the first warrior didn't miss. Chapter 20. Alagai Sharak. 328 AR.
Great Khaji, Spear of Evaram, grant strength to your warriors' arms and courage to their hearts this night, as they go forth to your holy work.
Marlin shifted uneasily as the Damaji bestowed the blessings of Khaji, the first deliverer, on the Dal Sharam. In the north, claiming the deliverer was just a mortal man might get you into a fistfight, but it was no crime. In Krasia, such heresy was punishable by death. Khaji was Evaram's messenger, come to unite all mankind against the Alagai. They called him Shar Damaka, first warrior priest, and said he would return to unite man again one day when they were worthy of Sharak Ka, the first war. Any who suggested otherwise came to a quick and brutal end. Arlan wasn't such a fool as to voice his doubts about Khaji's divinity, but the holy men still unnerved him. They always seemed to be looking for an excuse to take offense at him, the outsider, and giving offense in Krasia usually meant death for the offender. But whatever discomfort Arlan might feel around the Damaji, he always swelled at the sight of Sharak Hora, the enormous domed temple to Evaram, literally meaning hero's bones. Sharak Hora was a reminder of what humanity was capable of, a building dwarfing any structure Arlan had ever seen. The Duke's library in Milne was tiny by comparison. But Sharak Hora was impressive for more than its size. It was a symbol of courage beyond death, for it had been decorated with the bleached bones of every warrior who had died in Alagai Sharak. They ran up the support beams and framed the windows. The great altar was made entirely of skulls, the pews out of leg bones. The chalice that worshippers drank water from was a hollowed skull resting in two skeletal hands, its stem, the forearms, and its base, a pair of feet. Each gigantic chandelier was made from dozens of skulls and hundreds of ribs, and the great domed ceiling, 200 feet above, was covered in the skulls of the Krasian warriors' ancestors, looking down and judging, demanding honor. Arlan once tried to calculate how many warriors decorated the hall, but the task defeated him. All the cities and hamlets in Theza, perhaps 250,000 souls, couldn't have decorated a fraction of Sharak Hora. The Krasians were numberless, once. Now, all of Krasia's warriors, perhaps 4,000 in all, fit into Sharak Hora with room to spare. They gathered there twice each day, once at dawn and once at dusk, to honor Evaram, to thank him for Korlings killed the previous night, and to beg his strength in killing them in the night to come. Most of all, though, they prayed for the Shar Damaka to come again and begin Sharak Ka. To a one, they would follow him down into the core itself. Screams borne on the desert wind reached Arlan in the ambush pocket where he waited anxiously for the Korlings to come. The warriors around him shifted their feet, offering prayers to Evaram. Elsewhere in the maze, Alagai Sharak had begun. They heard the reports as the mending tribe, positioned on the city walls, cranked and fired their weapons, launching heavy stones and giant spears into the demon ranks. Some of these struck sand demons, killing or injuring them enough for their fellows to turn upon them. But the true purpose of the attack was to anger the Korlings, stirring them into a frenzy. Demons were easily enraged, and once so, could be herded like sheep at the sight of prey. When the Korlings were boiling, the outer gates of the city opened, disabling the outer ward net. Sand and flame demons charged through, wind demons gliding above them. Several dozen were usually allowed entrance before the gates closed and the net was re-established.
Inside the gates stood a group of warriors, banging spear against shield. These men, known as baiters, were mostly old and weak, expendable, but their honor knew no bounds. With shouts and whoops, they scattered at the demon's charge, splitting up in prearranged fashion to divide the demons and lead them deeper into the maze. Watchers atop the maze walls took down wind demons with bolas and weighted nets. As they crashed to the ground, stakers emerged from tiny warded alcoves to pin them before they could free themselves, shackling their limbs to warded stakes that were hammered into the ground, preventing them from returning to the core to flee the dawn. Meanwhile, the baiters ran on, leading the sand and occasional flame demons to their end. The demons could run faster, but they couldn't negotiate the sharp turns of the maze as easily as men who knew every twist. When a demon got too close, the watchers attempted to slow it with nets. Many of these attempts were successful. Many were not. Arlen and the others in the pushguard tensed, hearing the shouts as their baiters approached.
"Where?" a watcher called from above. "I count nine!"
Nine sand demons were far more than the usual two or three that reached an ambush point. Baiters attempted to whittle their numbers as they split up, so that an ambush seldom faced more than five. Arlen tightened his grip on the warded spear as the eyes of the Dal Shaaram went wild with excitement. To die in Alagai Sharak was to win entry into paradise.
"Lights!" came the call from above.
As the baiters led the demons into the ambush point, the watchers lit blazing oil fires before angled mirrors, flooding the area with light. Caught unawares, the Korlings shrieked and recoiled. The light couldn't harm them, but it gave the exhausted baiters time to escape. Prepared for the light, they flowed with practiced precision around the demon pits, dropping into shallow, warded trenches. The sand demons recovered quickly and resumed their charge, oblivious to the path the baiters had taken. Three of them ran right under the sand-colored tarps that covered the two wide demon pits, shrieking as they fell into the 20-foot holes. The traps sprung. The pushguard shouted and charged from their ambush pockets, spears leveled between circular warded shields to drive the remaining Korlings into the pits. Arlen roared past his fears as he charged with the others, caught up in the beautiful madness of Krasia. This was how he imagined the warriors of old, shouting down the instinct to run and hide as they leapt into battle. For a moment, he forgot who and where he was. But then his spear struck a sand demon, and the wards flared to life, streaking silver lightning into the creature. It shrieked in agony, but was swept away by the longer spears to either side of Arlen. Dazzled by the flare of defensive wards, none of the other men even noticed. Arlen's group drove the two remaining demons they faced into the open pit on their side of the ambush point. The pit's wards were a one-way kind, known only in Krasia. Korlings could enter the ring, but not escape. Under the packed dirt of the pit floor lay quarried stone, cutting off their path to the core and trapping them in the pits until dawn took them. Looking up, Arlen saw the opposite side wasn't doing nearly so well. The tarp had snagged as it fell into their pit, leaving some of the wards covered. Before the pit warder could clear the block, the two Korlings that had fallen in climbed through the gap, killing him. The pushguard on the far side of the ambush point had erupted into chaos, faced with five sand demons and lacking a working demon pit to drive them into. There were only 10 men in that unit, and the demons were in their midst, slashing and biting. "Retreat to the pocket," the Kai Shaaram on Arlen's side ordered. "The core I will," Arlen cried, charging across to aid the other group. Seeing an outsider display such courage, the Dal Shaaram followed, the commander shouting at their backs. Arlen paused only long enough to kick the tarp away from the demon pit and activate the circle. Barely missing a beat, he leapt into the melee, the warded spear alive in his hand. He stabbed the first demon in the side, and this time the other men couldn't miss the flash of magic as the weapon struck home. The sand demon fell to the ground, mortally wounded, and Arlen felt a rush of wild energy flow through him. He caught movement out of the corner of his eye and pivoted, his spear in line to block the razor teeth of another sand demon. The defensive wards along the spear's length activated before the Quarling could bite down, locking its mouth open. Arlen gave the spear a sharp twist, and the magic flared, snapping the creature's jaw. A third demon charged, but Arlen's limbs surged with power. He whipped the butt of his spear across, and the wards on its end sheared off half the Quarling's face. As it fell, he dropped his shield and twirled the spear in his hands, bringing it down hard to pierce the demon's heart. Arlen roared and looked about for another demon to fight, but the others had been driven into the pit. All about, men were staring at him in awe. "What are we waiting for?" he cried, charging into the maze. "We've Alagai to hunt!" The Dal Shaaram chanting, "Par Chin, Par Chin," followed. Their first encounter was a wind demon that swooped in, tearing the throat from one of Arlen's followers. Before the creature could climb skyward again, Arlen threw his spear, blasting through the Quarling's head with a shower of sparks and dropping it to the ground. Arlen retrieved his weapon and ran on, the wild magic of the spear sweeping him along like a berserker out of legend. As his band scoured the maze, their numbers grew, and as Arlen slew demon after demon, more and more took up the chant of "Par Chin, Par Chin." Forgotten were the warded ambush pockets and escape pits. Gone was the fear and respect of the night. With his metal spear, Arlen seemed invulnerable, and the confidence he exuded was like a drug to the Krasians. Flushed with the thrill of victory, Arlen felt as if he had broken from a chrysalis made anew by the ancient weapon. He felt no fatigue, though he had been running and fighting for hours. He felt no pain, though he bore many scrapes and cuts. His thoughts were focused only on the next encounter, the next demon to kill. Each time he felt the surge of magic punch through a Quarling armor, the same thought rang in his head. Every man must have one. Jardir appeared before him, and Arlen, covered in demon ichor, thrust the spear high to salute the first warrior. "Charam Ka," he cried. "No demon will escape your maze alive tonight." Jardir laughed, thrusting his own spear into the air in response. He came and embraced Arlen like a brother. "I underestimated you, Par Chin," he said. "I won't do so again." Arlen smiled. "You say that every time," he replied. Jardir nodded to the two sand demons Arlen had just slain. "This time, for sure," he promised, returning the grin. Then he turned to the men following Arlen. "Dal Shaaram," he called, gesturing to the dead Quarlings. "Gather up these filthy things and haul them atop the outer wall. Our sling teams need target practice. Let the Quarlings beyond the walls see the folly of attacking Fort Krasia." A cheer rose from the men as they hastened to his bidding. As they did, Jardir turned to Arlen. "The watchers report there is still battle in one of the eastern ambush points," he said. "Have you any fight left in you, Par Chin?" Arlen's smile was feral. "Lead the way," he replied, and the two men ran off, leaving the others to their work. They sprinted for some time out to one of the farthest edges of the maze. "Just ahead," Jardir called as they banked around a sharp corner into an ambush point. Arlen gave no thought to the quiet, his head filled with the stomp of his feet and the pounding of his blood. But as he turned the corner, a leg shot out from the side, hooking his foot and sending him sprawling to the ground. He rolled as he struck, keeping a grip on his precious weapon. But by the time he regained his feet, men had blocked the point's only exit. Arlen looked around in confusion, seeing no sign of demons or fighting. He had found an ambush, but it wasn't for the Quarlings. Chapter 21. Only a Chin. 328 AR. Shaaram moved in to surround Arlen, Jardir's elite. Arlen knew them all. Many had supped and laughed with that very evening, and fought beside many times before. "What is this?" Arlen asked, though in his heart he knew full well. "The spear of Khajiit belongs in the hands of the Shah Damaka," Jardia replied as he approached. "You are not he." Arlen clutched the spear as if afraid it might fly from his hands. The men that closed on him were the same warriors he had eaten with a few hours before, but there was no friendship in their eyes now. Jardir had done well in separating him from his supporters. "It need not be this way," Arlen said, backing away until the demon pit at the point center was at his heels. Distantly he noted the hiss of a sand demon trapped within. "I can make more of these," he went on. "One for every Dal Sharam. That's why I came." "We're capable of doing that ourselves." Jardir smiled, a cold split to his bearded face. His teeth flashed in the moonlight. "You cannot be our savior. You are only a chin." "I don't want to fight you," Arlen said. "Then don't, my friend," Jardir said softly. "Give me the weapon, take your horse, and go with the dawn, never to return." Arlen hesitated. He had no doubt Krasia's warders could replicate the spear as well as he. In no time at all, the Krasians could turn the tide of their holy war. Thousands of lives saved, thousands of demons killed. Did it matter who took the credit? But there was more at stake than just credit. The spear was a gift not for Krasia, but for all men. Would the Krasians share their knowledge with others? If this scene was anything to go by, Arlen thought not. "No," he said. "I think I'll have to keep it a little longer. Let me make one for you, and I'll go. You'll never see me again, and you'll have what you want." Jardir snapped his fingers, and the men closed in on Arlen. "Please," Arlen begged. "I don't want to hurt any of you." Jardir's elite warriors laughed at that. They had all devoted their lives to the spear. But so had Arlen. "The Khorlings are the enemy," he screamed as they charged. "Not me!" But even as he protested, he spun, diverting two spear tips with a twist of his weapon and kicking hard into the ribs of one of the men, sending him crashing into another. He dove into the rush, coming up in their midst, whirling his spear like a staff, refusing to use the point. He cracked the end across one warrior's face, feeling his jaw break, and dropped low as he followed through, smashing the metal spear like a club into another man's knee. A spear thrust cut the air just above him as the warrior dropped screaming to the ground. But unlike when he fought the Khorlings, the weapon now felt heavy in Arlen's hands. The endless energy that had driven him through the maze extinguished. Against men, it was just a spear. Arlen planted it on the ground and leapt into the air in a high kick to a man's throat. The butt of the spear struck another's stomach, doubling him over. The point gashed a third man's thigh, making him drop his weapon to clutch the wound. Arlen retreated from the responding press, putting the demon pit at his back so they couldn't surround him. "Again I underestimate you, though I promised I wouldn't," Jardir said. He waved, and more men came forward to add to the press. Arlen fought hard, but the outcome was never in doubt. A shaft struck the side of his head, knocking him down, and the warriors fell on him savagely, raining blows upon him until he let go of the spear to cover his head with his arms. As quickly as that, the beating stopped. Arlen was hauled to his feet, his hands pinned behind him by two thickly muscled warriors, as he watched Jardir bend over and pick up his spear. The first warrior clutched his prize tightly and looked Arlen in the eyes. "I'm truly sorry, my friend," he said. "I wish there could be another way." Arlen spat in his face. "Evaram is watching your betrayal," he shouted. Jardir only smiled, wiping the spittle away. "Don't speak of Evaram, Chin. I am Sharam Ka, not you. Without me, Krasia falls.
Who will miss you, Parchin? You will not fill so much as a single tear bottle.
He looked to the men holding Arlen. Throw him into the pit. Arlen hadn't recovered from the shock of impact when Jardir's own fine spear dropped down, the stick quivering in the dirt in front of him. Looking up the sheer 20-foot walls of the pit, he saw the first warrior looking down on him.
You lived with honor, Parchin, Jardir said, and so you may keep it in death. Die fighting, and you will awaken in paradise.
Arlen snarled, looking at the sand demon on the other side of the pit as it rose into a crouch. A low growl issued from its muzzle as it bared rows of razor-sharp teeth. Arlen rose to his feet, ignoring the pain in his bruised muscles. He reached slowly for the spear, keeping his eyes locked with the demon's. His stance, neither threatening nor fearful, confused the creature, and it paced back and forth on all fours, unsure. It was possible to kill a sand demon with an unwarded spear. Their small, lidless eyes, normally protected by the bony ridges of their brow, went wide when they pounced. A precise thrust to that one vulnerable spot, if driven hard into the brain beyond, could kill the creature instantly. But demons healed with magical speed, and an imprecise thrust, or one that didn't penetrate fully, would only enrage it further. Without a shield, in the dim light of the moon and oil lamps above, it was a nearly impossible task. While the demon puzzled out his behavior, Arlen began to slowly drag the point of the spear in the dirt, scratching lines of warding directly in front of him, the calling's most likely path. The creature would quickly find its way around, but it might buy him time. Stroke by stroke, he cut the symbols into the dirt. The sand demon drifted back to the pit walls where the shadows thrown by the lamplight above were greatest. Its tan scales blended with the clay, making it nearly invisible. Only its wide black eyes stood out, reflecting the scant light back at him. Arlen saw the attack before it came. The demon's corded muscles bunched and twitched as it tapped down its hind legs. He carefully positioned himself behind his completed wards and then broke eye contact, as if in submission. With a growl that erupted into a roar, the Corling launched itself at him, more than 100 pounds of talon, fang, and armored muscle. Arlen waited until it struck the wards, and as soon as they flared to life, he thrust hard at the exposed eye, the demon's momentum adding power to his blow. Marching from above, the Krasians cheered. Arlen felt the spear point dig in, but not deeply enough before the thrust and the flare of magic threw the creature back across the pit, shrieking in pain. Arlen glanced at the spear and saw the point had broken off. He saw it glinting in the moonlight from the demon's eye as it shook off its pain and got its feet back under it. It clawed at its face and the point came free. Already the bleeding had stopped. The Corling growled low and began to slither toward him, crawling on its belly across the pit's floor. Arlen let it stalk, racing to complete his semicircle. The demon pounced again, and again the makeshift wards flared, stopping it cold. Arlen thrust again, this time attempting to drive the broken point of the spear down its maw to the more vulnerable flesh of its throat. The Corling was too quick, catching Arlen's spear in its jaws and pulling it from his grasp as it was thrown back again.
Night, Arlen cursed.
His circle was far from complete, and without the spear he had no hope of finishing it. Recovering from the blow, the sand demon was completely unprepared as Arlen leapt from behind his wards and tackled it. Above, the spectators roared. The Corling scratched and bit, but Arlen was quicker, maneuvering behind it to put his forearms under its armpits, locking his fingers behind its head. He drew himself up to his full height, lifting the demon from the ground. Arlen was larger and heavier than the sand demon, but he couldn't match the sinewy strength of the Corling as it thrashed. Its muscles felt like the cables used in the quarries of Milne, and its back claws threatened to cut his legs to ribbons. He swung the creature about, slamming it into the wall of the pit. Before it could recover from the impact, he drew back and slammed it again. His grip was weakening against the powerful creature's onslaught, so he threw his weight about one more time, hurling it into his wards. Magic brightened the pit, jolting the demon on impact, and Arlen snatched up the spear and darted back behind his wards before it could recover. The enraged demon launched itself at the wards repeatedly, but Arlen quickly completed a makeshift semicircle with the pit wall at his back. There were holes in the net, but he hoped they were too small for the demon to find and squeeze through. But hope failed a moment later as the Corling leapt onto the pit wall, its talons digging into the clay. It moved along the side of the wall toward Arlen, bared fangs wet with drool. Arlen's hasty wards were weak, with a short radius of protection, not much higher than the demon could jump. It wouldn't take the Corling long to realize it could climb above them. Steeling himself, Arlen placed his foot over the ward nearest the wall, cutting off its magic. He kept his foot an inch off the floor so as not to scuff the marking. He waited until the demon leapt, then stepped back, uncovering the ward. The demon was halfway across when the net reactivated, banishing Corling flesh from its line. Half the creature fell into the circle with Arlen. Half dropped with a thump outside. Even severed from its hindquarters, the Corling clawed and bit at Arlen as he scrambled away, keeping it back with his spear. He crossed the wards, trapping the sand demon's torso in the semicircle, still twitching as it oozed black ichor into the dirt. Arlen looked up, seeing the Krasians staring at him open-mouthed. He scowled and snapped the spear over his knee. Inspired by the demon, he jabbed the broken end high into the soft clay of the pit wall. He pulled hard, his biceps bulging, and as he began to rise, he swung his other arm up, sticking the spear's broken head farther up the wall. Hand over hand, Arlen climbed the 20-foot wall of the pit. He gave no thought to what lay behind or what waited above. He focused only on the task at hand, ignoring the burning strain of his muscles, the tearing of his flesh. As he crested the edge of the pit, the Krasians backed away, their eyes wide. Many of them invoked Everam and touched their foreheads and hearts, while others drew wards in the air to protect them as if he were a demon himself. His limbs like jelly, Arlen struggled to his feet. He looked at the first warrior through blurry eyes. "If you want me dead," he growled, "you'll have to kill me yourself. There are no more Corlings left in the maze to do your work for you." Jardir took a step forward, but hesitated at a murmur of disapproval from some of his men. Arlen had proved himself a warrior. Killing him now wouldn't be honorable. Arlen was counting on that, but before the men had time to think it through, Jardir snapped forward, striking him on the temple with the butt of the warded spear. Arlen was knocked to the ground, his head ringing and the world spinning, but he spat and put his hands under himself, pushing hard against the ground to regain his feet. He looked up, only to see Jardir moving again. He felt the metal spear strike his face, and knew no more. Chapter 22. Play the Hamlets. 329 AR. Roger danced as they walked, four brightly painted wooden balls orbiting his head. Juggling standing still was beyond him, but Roger Halfgrip had a reputation to maintain, and so he had learned to work around the limitation, moving with fluid grace to keep his crippled hand in position to catch and throw. Even at 14, he was small, barely passing 5 feet, with carrot-red hair, green eyes, and a round face, fair and freckled. He ducked and stretched and turned full circles, his feet moving in tempo with the balls. His soft split-toed boots were covered in dust from the road,
and the cloud he kicked up hung around them, making every breath taste of dry dirt.
"Is it even worth it if you can't stay still?" Arik asked irritably. "You look like an amateur, and your audiences won't care for breathing dirt any more than I do."
"I won't be performing in the road," Roger said.
"In the hamlets you may," Arik disagreed. "There are no boardwalks there."
Roger missed a beat, and Arik stopped as the boy frantically tried to recover. He regained control of the balls eventually, but Arik still tisked.
"With no boardwalks, how do they stop demons rising inside the walls?" Roger asked.
"No walls either," Arik said. "Maintaining a net around even a small hamlet would take a dozen warders. If a village has two and an apprentice, they count themselves lucky."
Roger swallowed back the taste of bile in his mouth, feeling faint. Screams over a decade old rang out in his head, and he stumbled, falling on his backside as balls rained down on him. He slapped his crippled hand against the dirt angrily.
"Best leave juggling to me and focus on other skills," Arik said. "If you spent half the time practicing singing as you do juggling, you might last three notes before your voice breaks."
"You always said a jongleur who can't juggle is no jongleur at all," Roger said.
"Never mind what I said," Arik snapped. "Do you think Jason ripping golden tone juggles? You've got talent. Once we build your name, you'll have apprentices to juggle for you."
"Why would I want someone to do my tricks for me?" Roger asked, picking up the balls and slipping them into the pouch at his waist. As he did, he caressed the reassuring lump of his talisman, tucked safely away in its secret pocket, drawing strength.
"Because petty tricks aren't where the money is, boy," Arik said, drawing on his ever-present wineskin. "Jugglers make clats. Build a name, and you earn soft Milnese gold, like I used to."
He drank again, more deeply this time.
"But to build a name, you have to play the Hamlets."
"Golden Tone never played the Hamlets," Roger said.
"Exactly my point," Arik shouted, gesticulating wildly.
"His uncle might be able to pull strings in Angiers, but he has no sway in the Hamlets. When we make your name, we're going to bury him."
"He's no match for Sweet Song and Half Grip," Roger said quickly, placing his master's name first. But the buzz on the streets of Angiers of late had them reversed.
"Yes," Arik shouted, clicking his heels and dancing a quick jig.
Roger had deflected Arik's irritation in time. His master had become increasingly prone to fits of rage over the last few years, drinking more and more as Roger's moon waxed and his own waned. His song was no longer so sweet, and he knew it.
"How far to Cricket Run?" Roger asked.
"We should be there by lunchtime tomorrow," Arik said.
"I thought the Hamlets could only be a day apart," Roger asked.
Arik grunted.
"The Duke's decree was that villages stand no farther apart than a man on a good horse might go in a day," he said. "A fair bit farther than you get on foot."
Roger's hopes fell.
Arik really meant to spend a night on the road with nothing between them and the Corlings but Gerald's old portable circle, which hadn't seen use in a decade.
But Angiers was no longer entirely safe for them. As their popularity grew, Master Jason had taken a special interest in thwarting them. His apprentices had broken Arik's arm the year previous, and stolen the take more than once after a big show. Between that and Arik's drinking and whoring, he and Roger really had two clats to click together. Perhaps the Hamlets could indeed offer better fortune. Making a name in the Hamlets was a rite of passage for jongleurs, and it seemed a grand adventure while they were safe in Angiers. Now Roger looked at the sky and swallowed hard. Roger sat on a stone, sewing a bright patch onto his cloak. Like his other clothes, the original cloth had long since worn away, replaced a patch at a time until only the patches remained.
"Set up the circle when you're done, boy," Eric said, wobbling a bit. His wineskin was nearly empty.
Roger looked at the setting sun and winced, moving quickly to comply. The circle was small, only 10 feet in diameter, just big enough for two men to lie with a fire between them. Roger put a stake at the center of the camp and used a 5-foot string hooked to it to draw a smooth circle in the dirt. He laid the portable circle out along its perimeter, using a straight stick to ensure that the warded plates lined up properly. But he was no warder and couldn't be sure he had done it right. When he was finished, Eric stumbled over to inspect his work.
"Looks right," the master slurred, barely glancing at the circle.
Roger felt a chill on his spine and went over everything again to be sure, and a third time to be positive. Still, he was uneasy as he built a fire and prepared supper, the sun dipping ever lower. Roger had never seen a demon, at least not that he remembered clearly. The clawed hand that had burst through his parents' door was etched forever in his mind, but the rest, even the calling that had crippled him, was only a haze of smoke and teeth and horn. His blood ran cold as the woods began to cast long shadows on the road. It wasn't long before a ghost-like form rose up out of the ground not far from their fire. The wood demon was no bigger than an average man, with knobbed and bark-like skin stretched hard over wiry sinew. The creature saw their fire and roared, throwing back its horned head and revealing rows of sharp teeth. It flexed its claws, limbering them for killing. Other shapes flitted on the edge of the firelight, slowly surrounding them. Roger's eyes flicked to Eric, who was drawing hard on his wineskin. He had hoped that his master, who had slept in portable circles before, might be calm. But the fear in Eric's eyes said differently. With a shaking hand, Roger reached into his secret pocket and took out his talisman, gripping it tightly. The wood demon lowered its horns and charged, and something surfaced in Roger's mind, a memory long suppressed. Suddenly, he was 3 years old, watching over his mother's shoulder as death approached. It all came back to him in that instant. His father taking up the poker and standing his ground with Gerald to buy time for his mother and Eric to escape with him. Eric shoving them aside as he ran to the bolt hole. The bite that took his fingers. His mother's sacrifice. "I love you." Roger gripped the talisman and felt his mother's spirit around him like a physical presence. He trusted it to protect him more than the wards, as the calling bore down on them. The demon struck the wards hard. Roger and Eric both jumped as the magic flared. Gerald's web was etched in silver fire in the air for a brief instant, and the calling was thrown back, stunned. Relief was short-lived. The sound and light drew the attention of other woodies, and they charged in turn, testing the net from all sides. But Gerald's lacquered wards held fast. One by one, or in groups, the wood demons were thrown back, forced to circle angrily, searching in vain for weaknesses. But even as callings continued to throw themselves at him, Roger's mind was in another place. Again and again he saw his parents die. His father burned, and his mother drowning the flame demon before shoving him into the bolt hole. And over he saw Eric shove them aside. Eric had killed his mother. As surely as if he had done the deed himself. Roger brought the talisman to his lips, kissing her red hair. "What's that you're holding?" Eric asked softly when it became clear the demons couldn't break through. At any other time, Roger would have felt a stab of panic at his talisman's discovery. But he was in a different place now, reliving a nightmare and desperately trying to sort out what it meant. Eric had been like a father to him for over 10 years. Could these memories really be true? He opened his hand, letting Arik see the tiny wooden doll with its bright red hair. "My mum," he said. Arik looked sadly at the doll, and something in his expression told Roger all he needed to know. His memory was true. Angry words came to Roger's lips, and he tensed, ready to charge his master, throw him from the circle, and let the Korlings have him. Arik lowered his eyes and cleared his throat, beginning to sing. His voice, soured by years of drink, took on something of its old sweetness as he sang a soft lullaby, one that tickled Roger's memory just as the sight of the wood demon had. Suddenly he remembered how Arik had held him in the very circle they now sat in, singing the same lullaby as Riverbridge burned. Like his talisman, the song wrapped itself around Roger, reminding him how safe it had made him feel that night. Arik had been a coward, it was true, but he had honored Callie's request to take care of him, though it had cost him his royal commission and ruined his career. He tucked his talisman away in his secret pocket and stared out into the night as images over a decade old flashed in his mind, and he tried desperately to make sense of them. Eventually, Arik's singing trailed off, and Roger pulled himself from contemplation and fetched their cooking utensils. They fried sausages and tomatoes in a small skillet, eating them with hard, crusty bread. After supper, they practiced. Roger took out his fiddle, and Arik wet his lips with the last drops from his wineskin. They faced one another, doing their best to ignore the Korlings stalking about the circle. Roger began to play, and all his doubts and fears fell away as the vibration of the strings became his world. He caressed a melody forth and nodded when he was ready. Arik joined him with a soft hum, waiting for another nod before beginning to sing. They played thus for some time, falling into a comfortable harmony honed by years of practice and performance. Much later, Arik broke off suddenly, looking around. "What is it?" Roger asked.
"I don't think a demon has struck the ward since we started," Arik said.
Roger stopped playing, looking out into the night. It was true, he realized, wondering how he hadn't noticed it before. The wood demons were crouched about the circle, motionless. But as Roger met the eyes of one, it sprang at him. Roger screamed and fell back as the calling struck the wards and was repelled. All around them the magic flared as the rest of the creatures shook off their daze and attacked.
"It was the music," Arik said. "The music held them back."
Seeing the confused look on the boy's face, Arik cleared his throat and began to sing. His voice was strong and carried far down the road, drowning out the demon's roars with its beautiful sound. But it did nothing to keep the demons at bay. On the contrary, the Korlings shrieked all the louder and clawed at the barrier as if desperate to silence him. Arik's thick eyebrows furrowed, and he changed tune, singing the last song he and Roger had been practicing. But the Korlings still swiped at the wards. Roger felt a stab of fear. What if the demons found a weakness in the wards, like they had... "The fiddle boy!" Arik called. Roger looked dumbly down at the fiddle and bow, still clutched in his hands. "Play it, fool!" Arik commanded. But Roger's crippled hand shook, and the bow touched string with a piercing whine, like fingernails on slate. The Korlings shrieked and backed a step away. Emboldened, Roger played more jarring and sour notes, driving the demons farther and farther off. They howled and put clawed hands to their heads as if in pain. But they didn't flee. The demons backed away from the circle slowly until they found a tolerable distance. There they waited, black eyes reflecting the firelight. The sight chilled Roger's heart. They knew he couldn't play forever.
Arik hadn't been exaggerating when he said they would be treated as heroes in the hamlets. The people of Cricket Run had no jongleurs of their own, and many remembered Arik from his time as the Duke's Herald, a decade gone. There was a small inn for housing cattle drivers and produce farmers heading to and from Woodsend and Shepherd's Dale, and they were welcomed there and given free room and board. The whole town showed up to watch them perform, drinking enough ale to more than repay the innkeep. In fact, everything went flawlessly, until it came time to pass the hat.
"An ear of corn!" Arik shouted, shaking it in Roger's face. "What are we supposed to do with that?"
"We could always eat it," Roger offered. His master glared at him and continued to pace. Roger had liked Cricket Run. The people there were simple and good-hearted, and knew how to enjoy life. In Angiers, crowd pressed close to hear his fiddle, nodding and clapping, but he had never seen folk so quick to dance as the runners. Before his fiddle was halfway from its case, they were backing up, making room. Before long, they were reeling and spinning and laughing uproariously, embracing his music fully and flowing wherever it took them. They cried without shame at Arik's sad ballads, and laughed hysterically at their bawdy jokes and mummery. They were, in Roger's estimation, everything one could ask in an audience. When the act was over, chants of "sweet song" and "half grip" were deafening. They were inundated with offers of lodging, and the wine and food overflowed. Roger was swept behind a haystack by a pair of raven-eyed runner girls, sharing kisses until his head spun. Arik was less pleased. "How could I have forgotten what it was like?" he lamented. He was referring, of course, to the collection hat. There was no coin in the hamlets, or little enough. But there was went for necessities, seed and tool and ward posts. A pair of wooden clats settled at the bottom of the hat, but that wasn't even enough to pay for the wine Arik had drunk on the journey from Angiers. For the most part, the runners paid in grain, with the occasional bag of salt or spice thrown in. "Barter!" Arik spat the word like a curse. "No vintner in Angiers will take payment in bags of barley." The runners had paid in more than just grain. They gave gifts of salted meat and fresh bread, a horn of clotted cream and a basket of fruit, warm quilts, fresh patches for their boots. Whatever good or service they could spare was offered with gratitude. Roger hadn't eaten so well since the Duke's palace, and for the life of him he couldn't understand his master's distress. What was coin for, if not to buy the very things that the runners gave in abundance? "At least they had wine," Arik grumbled. Roger eyed the skin nervously as his master took a pull, knowing it would only amplify Arik's distress, but he said nothing. No amount of wine could distress Arik so much as the suggestion that he shouldn't drink so much wine. "I liked it there," Roger dared. "I wish we could have stayed longer."
"What do you know?" Arik snapped. "You're just a stupid boy."
He groaned as if in pain.
"Woodsend'll be no better," he lamented, looking down the road. "And Sheepshaggers Dale'll be worse of all. What was I thinking, keeping this stupid circle?"
He kicked at the precious plates of the portable circle, knocking the wards askew. But he didn't seem to notice or care, stumbling drunkenly about the fire. Roger gasped. Sunset was mere moments away, but he said nothing, darting over to the spot and frantically correcting the damage, glancing fearfully at the horizon. He finished not a moment too soon. The callings rose as he was still smoothing the rope. He fell back as the first calling leapt at him, crying out as the wards flared to life.
"Damn you!"
Arik screamed at a demon as it charged him. The drunken jongleur stuck his chin out in defiance and cackled as the calling smashed against the ward net.
"Master, please,"
Roger begged, taking Arik's arm and pulling him toward the center of the ring.
"Oh, half grip knows best now,"
he sneered, yanking his arm away and almost falling down in the process.
Poor drunk sweet song doesn't know to keep away from calling claws.
It's not like that, Roger protested.
Now what's it like? Eric demanded. You think that 'cause the crowds cheer your name that you'd be anything without me?
No, Roger said.
Damn right,
Eric muttered, pulling again on his skin and stumbling away. Roger's throat tightened, and he reached into his secret pocket for his talisman. He rubbed the smooth wood and silky hair with his thumb, trying to call upon its power.
That's right, call your mum,
Eric shouted, turning back and pointing at the little doll.
Forget who raised you, who taught you everything you know. I gave up my life for you.
Roger gripped his talisman tighter, feeling his mother's presence, hearing her last words. He thought again of how Eric had shoved her to the ground, and an angry lump formed in his throat. No, he said. You were the only one who didn't. Eric scowled and advanced on the boy. Roger shrank back, but the circle was small and there was nowhere to go. Outside the circle, demons paced hungrily.
Give me that,
Eric shouted angrily, grabbing at Roger's hands.
It's mine, Roger cried.
They struggled for a moment, but Eric was larger and stronger and had two full hands. He snatched the talisman away at last and threw it into the fire.
No!
Roger shouted, diving toward the flames. But it was too late. The red hair ignited immediately, and before he could find a twig to fish the talisman out, the wood caught. Roger knelt in the dirt and watched it burn, dumbfounded. His hands began to shake. Eric ignored him, stumbling up to a wood demon that was hunched at the circle's edge, clawing at the wards.
It's your fault this happened to me, he screamed. Your fault I was saddled with an ungrateful boy and lost my commission. Yours!
The calling shrieked at him, revealing rows of razor-sharp teeth. Eric roared right back, smashing his wineskin over the creature's head. The skin burst, spraying them both with blood-red wine and tanned leather.
My wine!
Eric cried, realizing suddenly what he had done. He moved across the ward as if he could in some way undo the damage.
Master, no!
Roger cried. He dove into a tumble, reaching up with his good hand to grab Eric's ratty ponytail as he kicked at the backs of his master's knees. Eric was yanked back away from the wards and landed heavily atop his apprentice.
Get your hands off of me!
Eric cried, not realizing that Roger had just saved his life. He gripped the boy's shirt as he lurched to his feet, shoving him right out of the circle. Corling and human alike froze in that moment. Awareness dawned on Eric's face, even as a wood demon shrieked in triumph and tamped down, launching itself at the boy. Roger screamed and fell back, having no hope of getting back across the wards in time. He brought up his hands in a feeble attempt to fend the creature off, but before the calling struck, there was a cry, and Eric tackled the demon, knocking it away.
Get back to the circle, Eric cried.
The demon roared and struck back hard, launching the jongleur through the air. He bounced as he hit the ground, the flailing limb snagging the rope of the portable circle and pulling the plates out of alignment. All around the clearing, other callings began to race to the breach. They were both going to die, Roger realized. The first demon made the charge at him again, but again Eric grabbed at it, turning it aside.
Your fiddle, he cried. You can drive them back!
As the words left his lips, though, the calling's talons dug deep into his chest, and he spit a thick bubble of blood.
Master!
Roger screamed. He glanced at his fiddle doubtfully.
Save yourself!
Eric gasped just before the demon tore out his throat. By the time dawn banished the demons back to the core, the fingers of Roger's good hand were cut and bleeding. It was only with great effort that he straightened them and released the fiddle.
He had played through the long night, cowering in the darkness as the fire died, sending discordant notes into the air